Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 36, the all-new, all-different DCU!
And me?
And everybody!
The purpose of Shortbox Showcase is to talk about topics in comics that fall outside of our solo shows.
We talked last episode about Convergence, and of the 2 months of miniseries that made up that event.
In this episode, we'll be talking about the new DC titles that we've picked up in the aftermath. And it's important to point out, not all of these are part of the official new DC YOU. It's just the stuff we've decided to check out because they were promoed in those Convergence books, seemed pretty interesting, were right up our alley. But first, feedback.
We mentioned recently that we may have missed some feedback from our old buddy Noel Thingvall on older episodes, and wanted to talk about one of those comments here. Also wanted to remind anybody who has come to the show recently and is working their way through the old episodes, when you do, feel free to leave feedback on those old episodes. We have no problem revisiting topics from earlier shows.
Yeah, a lot of the point of this show is that it is just a conversation. We like getting new people involved in old conversations.
Nothing wrong with that. On episode 22, under Red Comics, Noel talked about the 70s Marvel book The Human Fly. It was a predecessor of sorts to Dazzler, and that they wanted to hire a real person, a stuntman in this case, to take on the identity of the hero so as to spread the book to broader markets. And this was them trying to tie into the Daredevil stuntman craze of the period, which they'd already had success with by rejiggering Ghost Rider. The stories were often mundane and quaint, but Human Fly was one of the first titles Bill Mantlo was handed to develop from the ground up, and he turned it into a nice tale of a man so heavily injured that most of his bones had been lined with steel splints. And Human Fly got through everything because he had this secret support team of disabled former stunt performers who all pulled together for his cause and gradually work out ways to do together as a team what they're no longer capable of doing individually. It was a really fun, quietly clever and entertaining book, and is one of the reasons Mantlo became the go-to guy for adapting odd, licensed work nobody else could figure out.
Huh. That does sound really interesting. I'd heard about The Human Fly in passing, probably from Noel, just in Twitter and whatever, because he does quite like this series. I might actually go and check it out, because as you have pointed out on Quarterbin many, many times, Bill Mantlo knows how this writing thing works.
Yes.
That premise sounds really, really interesting. Of course, me and my love of Daredevil, I'm all about the disabled superheroes working through some form of whatever in order to still be a hero and do great things.
I think it would help if you could put yourself also into the 1970s mindset of Evel Knievel. Stunt driver, motorcycle, Daredevil being an actual thing?
Me trying to relate and enjoy the mindset that created media from the 70s? I have no idea why you think that I would ever be interested. Yeah, I'm probably going to pick this up.
It's a little Bronze Age-y.
It really is.
In the best way possible.
When I'd first heard of it, I was afraid it was going to be a little bit more Nightcat. And if anyone hasn't heard of this, Google it. It is insane. That is Dazzler meets Lady Gaga, and there are no other words for it. This sounds like it might be an actual interesting book with, like, plot and characters.
Now, I throw this out to our listeners and to you, Emily, that Ben Avery is covering Human Fly issues intermittently over at the Comic Book Time Machine podcast.
Huh! Ben Avery. You might get a new listener out of this.
See?
We also heard from Bradley Null on the topic of antiheroes. Let me start with the question, wouldn't it have been nice if the alignment chart had been started by a professor of literature rather than a game?
Yeah, that was the D&D alignment chart that you talked about in terms of a tool for determining hero versus anti-hero versus sympathetic villain. I think that's an interesting point. I am personally a fan of things that professors come up with.
Yes. And the nice thing about the alignment chart is that it's it's almost like a blend between a political spectrum chart and a personality chart.
Mm, okay, right.
It kind of hits on both of those. That you can be a villain who is chaotic good, or a hero who is lawful neutral. That it doesn't actually determine your actions or your motivations, just your inclinations. There should be more discussion of the alignment chart in literary circles. Bradley continues, it's a very useful tool for literary discussion, but once people hear it came from D&D, half just stopped paying attention.
Of course, if you'd said it come from a professor, the other half would have stopped paying attention, so...
I found this dismissal frustrating since I was in junior high. I have been told that I get too loud when discussing this.
In the interest of full disclosure, Bradley did not use all caps when typing this email. Congratulations!
Woo! I've had an argument about Zorro and Robin Hood with a friend for many years. He has insisted that the only difference between the two is setting. I have taken the oppositional argument. Listening to this episode, I officially concede and switch. In fact, Zorro, Batman, Green Arrow, at least until you take his fortune, and Robin Hood are all from the same template. Rich guys who fight a corrupt system as outlaws. Bradley also recommends Mark Waid's Incorruptible as a book that explores the anti-hero sympathetic villain line. I'm not usually interested in sympathetic villains. It's why I've never bothered reading any Punisher or Deadpool.
Mm-hmm.
But I am currently reading Mark Waid's Daredevil. And, of course, it is fantastic. So I'm intrigued by Mark Waid's writing. I might pick that one up, too.
Interesting, yeah. And then Bradley moves on to the title character for that podcast episode. Ah, Rorschach. Few fictional characters have caused me more arguments.
Yes.
He says that he bought Watchmen from his LCS, starting with 1 through 3 as back issues when 4 was new. And then month by slow, agonizing month. Dan, Mike, Bill, and I argued over who was the hero of the book. I was the Night Owl guy at the time. Bill was the Rorschach guy. We argued as each issue came out. We argued in the LCS. We argued on early internet bulletin boards. We argued everywhere. We flamed. I have since switched who I think the hero is at least twice. Currently, I'm in the Ozymandias has a point school of thought, but Bill stands by his Rorschach is pure stance. So I have been literally arguing about how Rorschach is not the hero since the character's fourth appearance with no end in sight. Anyway, thanks for the thoughtful and thought-provoking podcast. Faster than a speeding turtle, more powerful than a loco dog, able to leap, he is Bradley Man.
Thank you, Bradley Man.
More of our listeners need cool sign-offs. I'm throwing that down as a challenge.
A challenge the fruits of which we will reap
and regret.
And, weep.
And regret.
Count Druncula, a.k.a. the guy with the coolest name ever, a.k.a. Ryan Daly, of the new Secret Origins podcast and the Flowers and Fishnets show about Black Canary, wrote in for our TV episodes. Hey, Professor and Emily. I had a blast listening to this episode of your podcast about Marvel TV. I did binge watch Daredevil the day it came out. Circumstances allowed me this luxury. I started watching at roughly 9 a.m. and finished the season at 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't know if I could ever do this again because it was exhausting. On Professor Allen's suggestion of releasing the Netflix shows one per day for 2 weeks, he thought that this would be an interesting idea. I wonder if it would force the show to reflect more of the traditional cliffhanger model, and whether that would be good or not.
That's a point I hadn't thought of. We had talked about how much we like this model of TV, of not having to write to cliffhanger, certainly for commercial breaks, and even for episode breaks. And you know, releasing even once a day... Though it would have, you know, I think, helped Ryan get a little more sleep that day.
Sleep is for the weak and people who don't have Netflix accounts.
That, I do think that that would pull shows back into that traditional cliffhanger model. So there probably is some balance there.
Yeah. He then takes Professor Allen to task for his biggest complaint of the show. I can't believe that S.H.I.E.L.D., or the Avengers would take an interest in Wilson Fisk's escape. Fisk wasn't a metahuman or a war criminal, barely even the kingpin. He was a supposedly legitimate businessman with some minor political aspirations. Nick Fury wouldn't send Cap if Bernie Madoff escaped from federal custody.
I can sort of agree with that in the specifics, but I still think that that escalation from street level to, like, mega huge boss battle televised across the city of New York maybe would have drawn some attention from someone in the Marvel U. That's all I was saying. It was the escalation from street level to closer to supervillain boss battle that I was trying to get at. But I think technically speaking, he's probably right.
Also, something that I liked was that the reveal to the world of who Wilson Fisk really is.
True.
Was a explosion that it's implied all of it took place over the course of one day.
Right.
That the crooked cop walks into the police station at like 3 a.m. Nelson and Murdoch and Paige get the call at 8 a.m.
Right.
Confession at 9, list of people to arrest at 10, 10 p.m. over the course of like 12 hours. They're just arresting everyone. I can see that. I can buy that,
yeah,
then.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If
that it's not like
if you do compress it to that like short a time frame.
Like Fisk hadn't even been arraigned yet. Right. You know. He was just being arrested. I'm with Ryan on this one. That it would be cool and we would have liked it to have the Shield just sort of show up out of nowhere, which again, I am reading the Mark Waid run of Daredevil
and
now. And there is one of the greatest panels ever of the very
Shield
end of
flying at
very end of an issue. Matt ducks, and there goes a Shield whooshing right over the horns. That would have been nice to have in the show, but
that probably would have been more of a misfit than I sort of see that scene itself as just a bit of a misfit, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm only going to say this because I think Ryan is a new listener, and I don't want to alienate him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might be, you know, right. Let's move on, okay?
Okay. He continues by adulating us for our rendition of Shake It Off at the end.
One of the highlights of my podcasting career.
So proud of that. So proud of that.
And then our old buddy from Indiana, former guest on the show, Michael Bradley, wrote in also about both TV episodes we did. Michael is, of course, from the Superman and Batman show and The Thrilling Adventures of Superman. And, let's be honest, is the brains of the operation at the Tangent Comics podcast, Parallel Lines.
We are really lucky that Sean likes us.
Sean Engel, nicest man in Oklahoma.
Nicest man on the internet.
Michael confesses to not currently be watching any of the comics-related television programming, which he admits is shocking.
Ah! Ah!
I know. Despite this allegedly egregious geek cred-ruining act, I did listen to both of your Shortbox Showcase TV season wrap episodes in their entirety. Let me reiterate. I'm not watching, but I listened to both episodes. Is there an award for that? A physical or monetary prize would suffice. I'm not picky.
You know what? Expect a check with 20% of the income we have made off of this show.
That seems reasonable. In the meantime, here's some thoughts on our thoughts. On spoilers, Michael says, I completely spoiler with what you said about spoilers. Too many times, spoiler, spoiler, before someone spoiler, and I can spoiler how that would make someone spoiler. Rosebud is Luke's father and Darth Vader is a sled. Deal with it! All of the Marvel stuff, he confesses to being horribly behind on, but one benefit of that is I'll be a little less reluctant to give up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., as almost everyone I've heard talking about it says the next season does kick it up a notch. So I think he might be planning on just foregoing season one.
You know, I will blame no one, but I'll just be over here with my happy fuzzy memories and ignoring everything that happened afterwards. Because
see,
I just
between
don't
the two of you, you
yeah, between the two of us, we make one complete fan.
He then compares Gotham to Smallville, saying he's just tired of that general premise. I'd prefer superheroes now, not soon to be superheroes. Hopefully, folks are enjoying it, though. What I was thinking in terms of sort of the Gotham to Smallville correlation is that in comics, there have been a ton of Gotham-centric comic series that don't feature Batman.
Mm-hmm.
There are far fewer Smallville or Metropolis comic books without Superman.
Yeah. Or
there's some.
Or a super someone. Yes. That you have your Superboy, your Supergirl, yes. Super Pets, which we just forget
but
about.
There's a lot of Gordon's Law, GCPD,
love
Gotham
GCPD.
Central, Gotham by Midnight we'll talk about, Gotham Academy. There just seems to be the potential of doing more Gotham-related stories that don't have to feature the Batman particularly. That is, that's been done in comics some.
And something very famous about Batman and Gotham is that Gotham is very much a character. The city mm-hmm. is a character in a lot of those senses. And the police department is such a vital part right. of that city. Although both are horribly, horribly, barely at all functional, the way that they sort of limp along is kind of the backbone of a lot right. of stories that feature Batman. So, and I think the problem is when you take Superman out of Smallville, there's not a lot left. But there is enough content and interesting characters and plot lines and stuff that you can do set in Gotham that does not have to directly involve a bat.
At least.
Yet.
Right. Michael then poses a very interesting question to you, Emily. As someone who watched Firefly from the beginning, I can completely feel Emily's pain regarding the cancellation of Constantine. Question for her, though. You have the option to resurrect the show, but the only way the network will agree to it is to alter the show to Constantine's pal, Jimmy Olsen. Emily, do you accept these terms?
Never surrender! Never surrender! You'll never take me alive, Michael Bradley!
You gotta balance love for Constantine, hatred for Jimmy Olsen.
My love for Constantine is like my hate for Jimmy Olsen, for both are infinite.
He then moves on to iZombie, where the two of you are at least on common ground, perhaps. He says it looks like a lot of fun. He's not into zombies, but knowing it's less gore and horror, more action comedy, raises his interest. I loved Veronica Mars and enjoyed the one episode of Dead Like Me I've seen. He did not watch the leaked Supergirl episode like us. He wants to watch it when it airs. But after reading interviews with Melissa Benoist, which he claims I pronounced correctly, booyah!
4 points for you.
And watching the extended trailer, I've moved from cautiously optimistic to hesitantly eager.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the idea of Superman having a presence in that larger universe, even if he's not a character, makes me really happy. More Superman is never a bad thing.
I'm down with that. See also Smallville.
Less Superman was kind of a bad thing. Legends of Tomorrow, Air on the Flash. Man, 5 years ago, I would have been all over these shows. Today, I feel like I should be, but I'm just not excited enough to watch. Similar to Gotham, though, I'm glad folks are enjoying them. And I do think it's interesting that he points out that we are in such a good place as geeks. We can pick and choose.
Mm-hmm.
You can drop Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and not watch Arrow. I didn't watch a lot of iZombie. But between us, we are covering just about all the shows.
And that just about all is like 12.
It's a lot. It's a lot. It takes some scheduling and some juggling. And I think that's a really good place to be in.
Mm-hmm.
He closes with, thanks for a pair of interesting episodes. Now about my award.
Well, in the spirit of Marvel Comics, Michael has just earned himself a no prize.
Good job, buddy. Good job.
And since we're feeling particularly generous, we will extend that to everyone who sent in feedback. Thanks, you guys.
And Sean Engel does not get a no prize.
Not yet.
Wait, does that mean
he gets no prize?
So we will take a break here, drop in a few promos, and when we come back, we'll be talking about all the new DC books we've been reading lately.
Gathered together from the far reaches of the internet, are assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
The Superman Fan Podcast,
Superman in the Bronze Age,
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast,
The Schuster Herald Podcast,
It's Superman,
The Carazeroth Podcast,
The Amateur Steel, a John Henry Allen podcast,
The World's Best Podcast,
and
Radio Kale from SupermanHomepage.com.
Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
Scott Gardner,
Sam Rizzo,
Danny Sapp,
Matthew Epps,
I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Yunus, and co-host Scotty V
at SupermanPodcastNetwork.com.
And we're back.
One of the features of the second issues of all the Convergence minis was the previews for books coming out of or continuing out of that two-month break that was Convergence. And those previews helped shape what Emily and I are planning to read from this current version of the DCU.
The new DCU.
The new you.
The new YOU.
Thank you. So at this point, it looks like there may be three books, maybe a few more, that we have started buying and may pick up. And for us, by the way, three books a month is a lot of books.
It actually is. We're also very particular and selective about the books that we're actually going to buy, because you and I are big readers. So we will read just about anything, but it has to be pretty tailored to our tastes for us to actually, you know, spend money on it.
Hence the Quarterbin Podcast.
Hence the Quarterbin Podcast.
I have a low bar for what I'll read in trade from the library or if someone gives it to us or whatever. High bar for what I'll spend $2 to $3 to $4 for.
Mm-hmm. A grand total of three books were able to meet that, which is actually impressive. And that is an improvement over what the proper reboot DCU was
Correct.
Able to get us. With the new 52, we picked up two.
Every couple of years, they keep rebooting, restarting, rejiggering, and we'll pick up another book or two.
And
that is their master business plan.
Well, actually, yeah, it is. And the point is, this was not even technically, really, actually a reboot.
Right.
Which we appreciate, because mm-hmm. it meant that some books were able to continue over, and also gave a chance for moving around creative teams and putting together interesting concepts and ideas and throwing a bunch of occasionally very bizarre spaghetti at the walls to see what sticks.
So we're going to talk about what we've read and what we've heard about other books as well. And I personally don't consider anything that we're going to say to be terribly spoilerific, but as we've discussed
spoilers,
before,
first issues, there's setup.
Yes, but still people want to read the first issue and be surprised by
the concept.
Something. People have different definitions of spoilers than we do.
Yeah, this is true.
So if you don't want to know anything about the books,
just don't listen to this episode. Just go home.
Fast forward to the end for the end of show clip.
We will not judge you.
Now, as we mentioned last episode, our good friend, listener, feedbacker, The Puzzler 6, wrote in to let us know the books he was looking forward to in this wave of DC. And they included Green Lantern Lost Army, Omega Men, Martian Manhunter. Now, none of those were on our list, but he did mention Batman Beyond, which we expressed some interest in, but that was that one that was in the preview, and it was a different version?
Yeah, I just heard that there was going to be a Batman Beyond, and I was intrigued, but it's not Terry McGinnis, it's an older Tim Drake, and
gotcha.
I was, I mean, the entire point of Batman Beyond is young Batman.
That didn't work for you.
I didn't quite see the point of it.
Another one that he mentioned was one that we had mentioned as well, Dark Universe. And in the months that have passed since then, that book has been pushed back, which might be a nice way of saying shelved forever.
Yeah.
Now, we have talked before, you and I, about our appreciation for the miniseries.
Yes.
And that there's not enough miniseries. You know, yeah. I'm not talking about an event miniseries with a million tie-ins or something like that. I mean, an actual fully contained miniseries.
Or something like Vibe that gets to the end of a story arc and the story arc ending becomes the series ending.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cancellation does not count.
Exactly. But I definitely plan on picking up the trade for the Batmite miniseries, and I have heard shockingly good things about Bizarro as well.
I have too. I will not be buying either of these, but since you're buying both, I'll probably read them. For anyone who listened to last episode and us talking about Convergence, our listeners know I am not a big humor mag person.
Right.
It doesn't work for me. If it's just a gag comic, a web comic, a four-panel strip in the papers, you know, fine, whatever. But it's not my thing. So Bizarro, I'm sure, is awesome. And I have heard that there is a non-annoying Jimmy Olsen.
Those words don't make sense.
I know.
I don't understand that.
So.
Yeah, I have not heard a single negative thing about Bizarro. And I especially liked what Bob Fisher had to say. Bob does host the Superman Forever Radio podcast. And Bob is one of the many, 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 many Superman fans who became increasingly disenchanted, disenfranchised by the way that DC has handled their favorite character over the last half decade, decade. But he was a huge fan of Bizarro issue one. And basically said, as someone who's given DC a lot of grief over the last X number of months, years, I feel compelled to say when they get the tone of a book perfectly. And that was his review of Bizarro. Yeah, that is not an outlier. That far from it. That is exactly what I've heard.
Another book that we were considering was Harley Quinn and Power Girl. I guess this is the downside of the mini, is that series that we heard were minis, we have since decided in a lot of cases to wait for the trade.
Pretty easy to pick them up and trade at the library if they're really good, at the store. There's something unique about comics being the ongoing soap opera, the ongoing serial nature of the story that never ends.
Mm-hmm.
But from a purchasing point of view, something kind of nice about $17.99 and it's done. I have the whole novel. I have the whole book. I have the whole DVD collection.
Yeah. So this one still sounds interesting. We still like it. But this, along with Dr. Fate, have moved to our we'll check it out later.
But listening for reviews, waiting to hear positive things. Mm-hmm. I've heard positive things about the Dr. Fate issue one as well.
I learned after Convergence, I really do like Levitz when he's not writing the Legion.
Yeah, I just think he gets so up in his head, tangled inside out with the Legion.
Yeah, there's just too much baggage that it really hamstrings himself. For me, I can take it or leave it, but he's really quite good at this whole writing thing, this wordsmithing part.
Now, for one of these weeks that we purchased books, you went to the store and looked at We Are Robin. That was one that had intrigued you. You looked at issue one of that.
This one I really, really liked the preview.
Right.
Because the preview for this was almost all of the dialogue was done in essentially AIM Instant Messenger. And that was just such a weird, cool-looking style of dialogue that I was, like, really into this concept and really wanted to see that, to have essentially just, I don't know, almost like montage, to have the action going on in the background and then have all of the conversations with the characters via text message. Because a lot of the point of this book was that it's sort of a pseudo-anonymous type social justice, street-level, vigilante, teen, semi-anarcho thing, which, of course, I am completely fascinated by. And it was sort of like Batman Inc. teen.
Right.
Where there were multiple Robins who could be sent out on missions, you know, depending on who was available, who was nearby, who didn't have school, who wasn't grounded at the time, et cetera, et cetera.
It was kind of like the Robin Squad.
Yeah.
Where, you know, when the call comes into the police, the dispatcher figures out who's closest and who's... Mm-hmm. Okay, I got it.
And so I really dug that concept. And something about that was because it was the AIM Instant Messenger, is it was actually a really bright book. Because all of the text bubbles, sort of like a Deadpool comic...
They're all different colors for characters. Okay.
When I got the book itself, it struck me as kind of bland, both in the sort of the setup and the way the plot was unfolding, and just visually was not as interesting as I was hoping.
You wanted the book to be more like the preview, and it fell a little short.
Basically, that was one of those unfortunate moments where they sold the book too strong, and I was like, yes, that's exactly what I want. I love this trailer, and then was a little disappointed by the final product. I'm still going to keep browsing the issues.
2 and 3 and see if it jumps back to that, maybe.
Yeah, maybe by 4 or 5 I'll decide. And if I decide to get it, I'm going to get the individual issues. Because that's a thing that we've talked about that really annoys us, is the way that the sales are counted.
To me, the business model that makes sense is that if they break even on the books, the floppies, and then make money on the trade with the sunk costs are different, printing costs are different. To me, that's the model. And they, as you said, they seem to have it flipped. They seem to want to make the profits on the floppies and then consider the trades to be sort of bonus money.
For a lot of people, even when they buy the floppies, they will then go and get the trade.
Right.
And of course, people who don't buy the floppies, who are like us, who are waiting for the trade, will buy the trades. And as libraries are starting to get a lot more comics, as comics are becoming more sort of common again, they're obviously not going to have the single issues. They're going to buy the trades.
And one nice thing that's happened over the last decade, comics becoming more mainstream, is that you can sell to the library board that you're going to pull out $1,000 every quarter and buy new trade paperbacks.
Yep.
A, because they're considered a somewhat more respectable
piece of print.
You know, yeah, than they were before, and because they get checked out like wild.
Oh, yeah.
What we're saying, but the drawback is that if you're not buying the single issues, you're sending the message to the company, or the message they're receiving.
Yes.
Is that you don't want the book, even if you're trade waiting. You may be trade waiting for ever and ever and ever.
Amen. So, if I decide that I'm going to get this, I am going to go back and get it in the floppies. Unless I hear it's canceled by issue 6, which, you know, maybe it will be. Hopefully not, because it seems like people are really sort of getting into this whole DCYOU. Things post-convergence seem to be looking pretty good numbers-wise.
Yeah. In terms of ones that we are definitely picking up and enjoying on the ongoing basis, one I wanted to mention is Starfire.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one we had mentioned previously in our preview episode, is one you were hoping would be good. And then when we read the preview in, I think it was in The Question,
it was everything we could have hoped for.
It was right on target, because the preview really helped me understand what this one was going to be. It is Starfire moving to the only place in the world where a somewhat scantily clad, orange-skinned person would fit in.
Key West.
It works.
I love this concept so much. The premise is that, especially in the preview in the first issue, there's not really a big bad. She's essentially on semi-vacation / study away in how to be an earthling.
This is the way I like to see a fish-out-of-water story told. I really liked those elements that were in the preview and then carried on into issue 1 as well. She does the classic take me to your leader speech.
Yes!
So she arrives in Key West, take me to your leader. And that's, I guess, the sheriff?
Yeah, the sheriff.
Count. So the female sheriff basically takes her new citizen under her wing for this first couple of issues. And I just think this was a fun, fun, fun story.
So much fun. For me, this really struck the perfect balance of sort of slice of life, daily comedy drama that I was really hoping for, because there are some moments that are kind of legit, you know, where Corey's explaining her backstory and the enslavement and her people being taken over and war and exile and all this stuff. But her perspective on all of this is so perfectly Starfire that she is upbeat in the face of all of this, that she just meets all of this ridiculousness that's happening all around her in Key West and just rolls with it.
Naive and cheerful.
Yes, exactly. The two adjectives that should always describe her is naive and cheerful. The two adjectives that were furthest from describing her in that terrible, terrible book, which we will not even mention again, except for the fact that the bikini that she was pointlessly wearing in Red Hood and the Outlaws number one is shown in a window as she goes shopping for, you know, actual human clothes. It's the first thing she's drawn to. It looks so comfortable! And the sheriff is just like, no. Absolutely not. You need to wear more than dental floss.
It's a very subtle, I mean, it is so subtle that we didn't catch it. It had to be pointed out to us that it, not only is it a bikini, it's
the exact bikini
from Red Hood and the Outlaw. So you did get a general message that this is going to be a different type of Starfire. And in that case, you really an Easter egg there that you're getting the specific message that this book
is not that book.
That book, exactly.
And that is everything that I was just hoping and dreaming for. Just make this not like that.
They specifically mentioned Commander, the sister. So obviously we expect her to show up at some point. It'll probably be some other super villainy afoot eventually, but there's really no fights in this first issue, except with a couple of guys we'll mention in a second. But no super-powered confrontation, and it appears to be maybe an issue too. There's not one either. Her first mission is really going to be fighting Mother Nature. There's a hurricane coming. So, you know, she's almost going to be, we imagine, sort of a deputized law enforcement / volunteer
Coast Guard.
For the next. So they have laid the groundwork for villains and supervillains and more traditional comic book
superheroics.
Yeah, confrontations and superheroics. But I like this, the idea that this first big bad that she's going to fight is a hurricane.
Yeah. And of course I like Teen Titans and I like Corey going and being a superhero and beating up bad people. But I do really like the indication that this is going to be much more about her being an alien, which I am so down with. It's literally the opposite of the Clark Kent. This is where the whole alien on Earth story works, and I, of course, can never buy it when it involves Superman, ever. Though in that preview, I did like that the only person Corey feels she can talk to about feeling out of place is Superman. I mean, he's essentially everyone's big brother. She's like, I just need some advice, Cal. And he's like, okay, go to Key West. You'll fit in. Like, they're all a bunch of freaks and weirdos there.
He's also figured that's how many thousand miles from Metropolis? Okay, good.
Far
Get
enough.
You out of my hair. Good.
So I like the feeling that more of her quote-unquote villains will not be so much bad guys. It'll hopefully be more of the alien invasion type stuff.
Right.
I know it probably won't happen, but the other story that I know Key West from is the Callahan books, and they have specifically made reference to how insane Key West is, that their patrons, which includes aliens, nobody bats an eye at. So I'm really wanting at some point that there's, you know, a fantasy fest, Mardi Gras, crazy costume ball, and an alien invasion happening at the same time.
And no one notices.
And no one notices. Like,
they just figure that's, as we say, that's Tuesday.
Fingers crossed for that joke at some point in the future. But I'm really digging the tone, the plot. The characters are fun. Most of the characters are Corey's new landlady, the sheriff we already mentioned, the landlady's nephew or son, the sheriff's brother. So it's...
They're building a cast around her.
Yes, and they're all normal human beings.
There was one confrontation.
Yes, our big fight scene.
There was a quote-unquote fight scene with a couple of, you know, surfer dude, frat boy type of guys at a bar. And I believe it was either the major spoilers or it may have been Chris on Mythmaking ETC. Somebody pointed out that those two dudes, they're not Blue Beetle and Booster, but they're pretty much Blue Beetle and Booster. They're wearing blue and gold. The guy in the gold t-shirt has a blue star on his shirt.
It's Blue and Booster. It is that frat bro relationship of like, hey man, check her out. She's hot. Oh dude, man, I totally saw her first. Which one of you saw me first? Hey lady, pay attention to me. Okay, I'm going to blow up your table now. Please stop paying attention to me. It's pretty great. Also, slightly tipsy Corey.
That does help too. So, that scene was funny. There was lots of, not just funny, but just, again, a word we've heard describing these new books that we barely ever heard in the 3.5 years of the New 52, FUN, fun.
Mm-hmm.
This was a fun read.
Last thing to mention about Starfire, and this goes back to the naivete, fish out of water, etc., etc. The dialogue in the story is all great, but what makes it just beautiful is Corey's thought bubbles, which is pretty much anytime anyone uses an idiom or some sort of metaphor.
Earth-American colloquialism of some kind.
And it just totally goes over her head and we get to see her mental pictures. It's pretty great. There's
thought bubbles sort of in a much more cartoony sort of drawing style.
Yeah, with little sparkles and it's adorable.
A well-thought-out book.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, well-executed book.
Good job, Amanda Connor.
And Jimmy Palmiotti. No surprise. Next up, speaking of no surprise,
hey.
The second book that we picked up was, of course, Constantine the Hellblazer.
What can I say? I liked Starfire, but I loved Constantine.
I loved Starfire and liked Constantine.
Constantine was exactly what I really was hoping for, what I needed. That it has that grim horror sort of feeling and definitely horror plot. But there is that gallows humor that John is famous for. And something that really annoyed me about the New 52 version of Constantine. And I went straight to the show, then I went back to
right. Some of the older
Alan
trades.
Moore Swamp Thing and the early issues of Hellblazer and then Justice League Dark. But I never read the actual New 52 Constantine, and right. What I have seen of him was that he was just a douche. And it really didn't get that likable part of the likable bastard description that really typifies John Constantine.
They got the bastardly bastard?
Yeah, that he's supposed to be funny and witty and charming and smart and all of these things, so you look over the fact that he's kind of a terrible person. In this book, it has really, I think, got that pretty much perfect. It's definitely lighter than the original Hellblazer stuff, so, you know, Andy Leyland probably did not like it nearly as much as I did. But it's very much a version of John Constantine that has been influenced by all of the previous
right.
versions, and I think has kept the best out of most of those versions.
So what's the opening scene when we first open the book? What do we get?
This story opens the way that really any story involving John Constantine should open, which is John buck-ass naked in the middle of a tailor's shop, covered in blood, with some lady attendant just staring dumbfounded at him as he says, "I promise, it's not what it looks like." Yes, it is absolutely
it is
what it looks
exactly
like.
Exactly what it looks like, it turns out.
Now, in this version, magic is much more common than in some of the previous John Constantine and Hellblazer versions. But I thought it was handled really well, that a lot of the magic really does play around perceptions and
almost more illusion-y type thing,
yeah.
Or reality-bending more, or
right. The way that John gets out of that first
piece
interaction, that first
spot of bother,
yes, is just by talking to the attendant and convincing her, nothing's wrong. And then getting out one of his business cards, writing credit card on it, and say, here, bill everything to this.
A little Jedi mind trick, these are not the droids you're looking for, sort
exactly.
of approach.
And then when he explains it, he says, a lot of the point of magic is just convincing people to look away.
Okay,
if people
right.
don't want to see something, it's really easy to convince them it's not there. So I like that idea of that's sort of how he gets away with this stuff, is that he is a con man, and he uses magic in his cons.
So it is actually possible that he won the doctor's psychic paper in a poker match.
Oh, I would not be surprised.
Talk a little bit about the art style, because the art is not standard comic book fare.
It is not. I don't know, it's odd, but I really dug it. Everything is sort of angular and a little bit exaggerated. Like, the eyes are all a little on the large side. It's not manga style.
No.
But it's...
it's just a little off of reality.
Yeah, it's just a little bit off. Even though the proportions are off, everything's mm-hmm. drawn fairly realistically. It's just, it's an interesting style. It's worth a look. So this was a book that I was going to get regardless. But the previews really did sell this one to me. Something that they did that I really appreciated for both Constantine and for Starfire was that the previews were completely self-contained 8-page stories that did not appear in the first issues. I was a little concerned
right.
that they were essentially going to publish the first 8 pages of the story, and then I would
so
only
we were
get...
we were going to be wasting some of that. Though, to be fair, $2.99 on all the books that we bought. Instead
Which
of $3.99. Now, I know there are $3.99 books out there. I think it helps that you and I don't tend to buy the big-name books that...
that cost more?
Detective Action, Superman, Batman, those are not the ones that are on our list. So we do tend to fall into the slightly more obscure $2.99 type books. But we were a little worried about even wasting that $2.99 or wasting 8 pages worth if we were just going to get
yeah.
the previews that we'd already seen. But they really were bridges. They really were sort of self-contained mm-hmm. introductions to these books.
So Starfire started essentially in medias res.
Right.
That the actual meeting of the sheriff was in the 8-page preview. For Constantine, it was essentially a mini quote-unquote case of John meeting someone. They mention that they got involved in some weird hinky magic stuff. He says that he can help. They trust him. They get screwed.
Yeah.
And he walks away at the end. That showed that the writing team for this book really understood the first rule of John Constantine. Never trust John Constantine.
Okay, I'm with you there, yes.
This story really does sort of follow in that tradition. John's just going about his daily business, being haunted by all of the people who have died in his wake, which was a great thing that they picked up from the early issues of Hellblazer.
Okay.
So going back and tying into that, he's being followed around by his ghostly peanut gallery, runs into a demonic ex-flame of his. They go to her club because she's having a slight imp problem, as happens when you bring John Constantine to do any sort of demonic pest control. Everything goes completely to hell. Butum tish. And he ends up essentially exorcising everyone in the building. Tricking the demon who hired him into hoisting herself by her own petard. It was a really, really solid story. Then right at the end, we get a little teaser where Gary Lester, one of his many ghosts, says that one of the other ghosts is dead. Actually dead. So the next story will be, how do you kill a ghost? Hellblazer stories are best when they're self-contained, one-off,
right.
single case, sort of X-Files-y, weird, bizarre
spread
happenings.
Out over multiple issues, but you like discrete stories.
Mm-hmm. So I think this will hopefully have a pretty good balance of monster, demon, freak of the issue, and also overarching plot.
We mentioned the art before, that it's just a little off, as you might like in a Constantine book. And there is a double page spread that is one of the best pieces of comic art I've seen in a long time. What it is Constantine and the club owner walking through all of the levels of the club, which of course are based on the 9 circles of hell from the Inferno. So it's over 2 pages. It's 10 panels, 1 panel for each of these levels. And you turn the book sideways, which I know annoys some people. This is the actual center of the book.
The center spread, yeah, essentially. And it is beautiful.
Each page is sort of broken into 5 skinny, long panels that go across the whole page. And it's basically them walking the entire length of that level of the club, then going down the stairs and walking back the other length and walking back the other length. So you have these 10 panels. Each panel is colored a different color. It's just really impressive art. Mm-hmm. And there's some good story happening there as well in the midst of their conversation.
Yes, and this page is essentially the exposition page.
Right.
Where, as they're walking through the various levels of the club, the demon is explaining, here's the trouble, here's how it's set up, here's all of the information you need to know. And John is, of course, being John and cracking jokes. And
anytime you have an info dump, it helps to do something unique with it. So you get to the end of the 2 pages, I'm blown away by the art, and I flip the page. Oh yeah, that was a 2-page info dump that I just got, and I didn't mind it.
Not at all.
So I think that is one that definitely met our expectations as well.
Mm-hmm. Met and, in my case, exceeded, which I had a high bar to start with.
Exactly.
So this book just really, really impressed me.
Another of the titles that I was interested in was Gotham Academy. Technically speaking, not a new book, because it was already 6 issues in. It started at the beginning of 2015. But I had heard some pretty good things about it. And I did not buy the next issue, which would have been issue 7. But I did check out the trade from the library, which had 1 through 6. I had heard good things about it. Basically, teens investigating some weird shenanigans at and around and underneath Gotham's premier private school, which is funded largely by Bruce Wayne.
As pretty much every institution in the city is.
Bruce Wayne appears a lot more than Batman appears, though Batman does appear.
Mm-hmm.
There were parts of this that I liked, but it's not going on my regular pull list.
Yeah, same here.
And I think part of the problem with me was maybe bad timing, and that I had just read volume 1 of a series called Liberty Vocational by novelist Naomi Novik. And that volume was called Will Supervillains Be on the Final? And had a lot of similarities to this one. Teens, school setting, sort of a manga influence in the art. In that one, the kids were superpowered, and here they're not. But there were a lot of similarities, and in comparison, Gotham Academy just came up a little short for me.
For me, this book really just never quite worked. It didn't quite click with me. It was simultaneously to Twilight and to Hardy Boys.
The mix just, even there was Scooby-Doo-ish.
It was very Scooby-Doo. Because I had heard some sort of rumblings about vaguely what the premise was, but I thought it was actually going to be more like Gotham, the TV show. Batman, high school alternate universe.
Gotcha,
and that there was younger versions of a lot of the villains and a young Bruce Wayne. There is a young Master Wayne, but not Bruce. And Killer Croc shows up, but very, very briefly. The stuff with Killer Croc, I think, was actually probably my favorite.
I liked the take on Croc, and then I liked where that part of the story went. That was some mystery with one of the characters' mothers, etc. So that's lays in some of the future groundwork.
Yeah, for me, I think there was just way too much setup and not enough plot. Like, there was hardly any story that was actually going on in this book. And there's even a sexy vampire, and by the time the sexy vampire showed up, I had pretty much lost all interest, but that was the moment where I was like, okay, and
check, please.
And we're done. I'm out of here. But then right after it, we got the stuff with Killer Croc, and I did like that, if only because the main character has trauma related to Batman. And so I liked the idea of her and her friends being saved by Killer Croc and viewing him as the hero who's helping them and protecting them, and Batman as the villain who's beating up their friend.
Right.
So that was interesting. And if it had been more of that, the kids sort of trying to understand the Arkham inmates side of the story, and less just them going to class and the main character whining about how she doesn't know herself. Which, I mean, to be fair, she has amnesia, I get it, but like,
she literally doesn't know parts of herself.
But man, that was like, it got really redundant. Now, that was the other thing, is that we read it in trade.
Right.
If there'd been a month between every 20 pages, I probably wouldn't have been as annoyed. I don't know. It's one I might keep up with it via, like, Wikipedia.
Right.
See where the plot goes. And honestly, I think this goes into the expectations that I brought to the book. But really, I just don't like the title. Because Gotham Academy implies it's either going to be a slice of life story about being in high school, but it's not. It is this Scooby-Doo, Hardy Boys, semi-supernatural, like, mystery club.
They do tie in a little bit of Gotham with a little bit of Arkham, but not enough. It almost could have been anywhere, or...
Well, I thought it worked well being set in Gotham.
Okay.
If I had known going into this that it was going to be a middle grade mystery club story, I think I would have been more on board with it. It literally took me until issue 4 when at the end of it they say, we should make a club and solve mysteries. And I was like, oh, that's what genre this entire book is, because it was so scattered and ADD in the first issues that I couldn't even figure out what genre this book was supposed to be. If it had some more indication as to what actual stories would be going on in this thing.
But you know the problem with that.
Yes.
If it hadn't been called Gotham Academy, it would not have been published. We talked about this a little bit last episode, or in any prior episode, about there being a lot of stories about Gotham.
If potentially, only because they'll sell.
And then therefore they create lots of stories that have Gotham in the name.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm down for stories set in Gotham. I'm down for all of the stuff about re-examining the assumption that Batman is a hero and that all of the Arkham inmates are, first of all, the assumption that they're all actually insane, which is a thing that Croc brings up of, like, I just don't fit in anywhere. I'm not actually nuts. I don't belong in an asylum. There's just nowhere else to put me. I was like, there's actually some stuff there about mental illness. And, of course, the main character has amnesia. And, like, this sort of stuff is interesting and can be examined because Arkham is a big deal in Gotham books. But, you know, you say this book wouldn't have been published if it didn't have Gotham in the title. I don't think we would have lost much.
But this idea of publishing a book because it has Gotham in the title does bring us to our favorite current DC book, which is Gotham by Midnight, which again was one that had, I think, 5 issues before Convergence. And as I pointed out, I think, on the Comics Reading Journal episode, plug.
Why didn't anyone tell us this book existed? It's literally Jim Corrigan solving crime in Gotham with a whole bunch of weirdos. That is so up our alley, they put our names on the sign.
Listener fail. This was one that was in the previews.
Oh, and I'm so glad it was in the previews.
Now, as we said, the first 5 issues were out. When I went to the LCS, I found 1 through 4. We have to find 5. 6 is out. We'll eventually get 5 and 6. So we have the first 4 to talk about. And really dug it. The preview, I think that was in Catwoman. The preview was terrific. Again, it's hard to think of a book more suited to us, as you said, Detective Spectre.
Yes.
Working in Gotham. Chris from Mythmaking ETC said, do you think it would have sold if DC had called it, as you said, The Spectre Solving Supernatural Crimes with an Ad Hoc Crew of Oddballs? To which I said, well, they would have sold us 1 copy.
Well, it would have sold us 2. I'd have bought my own, but...
Exactly. So we do understand that. That is one where the Gotham name probably needs to be there.
Yeah, and I think is earned at least as much as Gotham Academy, because Batman shows up about as much, just 3 panels. But I really dug this book. This is another one with really weird art.
This is the one that's almost Silent Hill. Isn't it the Silent Hill?
It is. It is Ben Templesmith, the guy who did a lot of the Silent Hill licensed comics.
And yeah, I knew it looked vaguely familiar. We haven't seen much. I haven't never read a Silent Hill comic, but I do know what they look like. And so I could definitely see that heritage in this book.
Yeah, and the biggest problem is that the Silent Hill comics, not terribly well written, but the art is definitely freaky.
Yeah.
And is perfectly suited, I think, to the story being told in Gotham by Midnight. Now, the art, I'm just saying this. I'm going to underline it, highlight it, just put in giant flashing letters on a billboard in the sky. The art is weird.
Like, it's freaky.
Really, really weird. With issue either 5 or 6, there was an art change.
Okay.
And I think it was issue 6, because the art change was shown in the new promo. And okay. I like the new art style more, just because it's easier to tell what's actually happening. But I will say this, is that the covers for Gotham by Midnight 1 through 4 are some of the best horror covers I've ever seen in my life. There's one with like a freaky nun with mouths for eyes and a skeletal Jim Corrigan being eaten by tentacles with a face and weird stuff.
I mean, it is a Gotham PD detective squad. They call themselves the Night Shift or whatever it is, the 13th Shift or something. And
Precinct 13.
And they investigate the weirder side.
The weirdest.
Of crime in Gotham. And unfortunately, since they are part of the Gotham PD, they actually do have to file paperwork.
And
do arrest reports and budgets. And so you have the normie
from
on the squad
Internal
from Internal Affairs saying, I keep reading your reports. They are unbelievable. How many silver crosses do you need to requisition? And Corrigan says, okay, well, you're on the team now, so we'll show you what we do.
If you want to come along, then you can fill out your IA report. Whatever you write up, I'll sign it.
So it is a vaguely detective book. It's probably 2/3 horror, 1/3 detective.
I was going to say, it is definitely, definitely leaning towards the straight-up Lovecraftian abomination type of supernatural horror. Mm-hmm. And it's really good. Seriously, if anyone actually does like Silent Hill, these are pretty good Silent Hill stories. Again, this story arc kind of wraps up in issue 5, so we have not gotten to the end of it. But there is a building doom and looming menace coming to Gotham. And it's very interesting. It's not necessarily demons in the Constantine sort of style of named demons from a specific circle of hell, but it's freaky.
It's in that ballpark.
It is definitely closer to that, but with a really strong eldritch just wrongness put all over it, or as the Spectre would say, abomination.
Yes. One thing we like, the slow burn on the Spectre, for basically 3.5 issues, it is Detective Jim Corrigan going about doing his detectiving work with a weird set of comrades in arms. But when he breaks out the Spectre, that's when you know he means business.
That is the nuclear option. And spoiler alert, when the Spectre shows up, it doesn't necessarily mean things are getting better. It actually usually means things are getting worse.
Yeah. It certainly means they have gotten worse. So Gotham by Midnight, Constantine, and Starfire are the three that we are definitely picking up new from the store regularly from this initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as you said, is a 50% increase on the 2 books we were picking up in the new 52, which is an infinity increase over the new books we had picked up for the prior
decade.
Years of your life.
Yeah.
We are generally not buying new books off the stands, people.
Shockingly, things seem to be looking up for DC. The quality of book in the wake of Convergence seems to really be on the rise.
Maybe the secret is the lesser deal they make it, the better the books. The bigger deal they make it, the less good the book. Or maybe they just learned the lesson of the new 52, I hope.
I hope so, too.
I've even heard vaguely good possible things about some of the Superman stories.
Yeah.
And if they could turn that big ship just a little bit in the... get it on a trajectory
towards not
positivity
sucking.
And bringing a few fans back, that couldn't be bad either. Like, maybe the new DCU is not a reboot, but maybe it's something even more exciting than that, a much-needed retooling of
yes.
the line, which I think is more what I'm getting from it.
Yeah, that is really what this feels like. It feels like the entire DC lineup, again, we don't know what's going on in the mainline books, and we've never
True.
Cared what's going on in the mainline books, but from what I've seen, that there has been sort of a across-the-board cleanup and tune-up.
New coat of paint on everything.
Yeah. Letting creators try new weird ideas.
It's a so far so good. We'd love to hear from you, our lovely listeners, what you've thought about these new DC books, if there are any that you're currently reading or expect to pick up on the trades. Especially if you're liking it, but even those books and changes and continuations of books, if you're not liking, let us know about that as well.
If you have some of that feedback to send to us, you can email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or leave a comment on our blog at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Also, if you want to join our Facebook page and see links and previews and images related to the episodes that we're posting and engage in some of our conversation, snark, and general nerdery there, just search for Relatively Geeky.
That does happen.
All of that.
If you like what we have going on here, if you could leave us an iTunes review, that would be great as well. Again, search Shortbox Showcase or Relatively Geeky. Just helps more people find us. So again, thanks for that feedback. And just in general, thanks for listening.
Catch you next time.
I will cut out most of the mockery of Sean Engel.
But we need to have as much of it to cut from as possible.
That's why they invented end of show clips.
Yes.
Hi, Sean.
We love you. We promise.
Bring us back on the Doctor Who show, please.
We like it. I promise next time I'll pick something with a better soundtrack.